Okay, so can you all see this screen? It's the best we could do. Somebody asked me, where's all this equipment come from? That's my laptop, that's Breathworks, and the screen is the centres, the one with the sellotape on the top.
It's not Breathworks screen.
So, okay, so why am I here? Well, first of all, thanks very much for coming. And I really don't know how this talk's going to go, okay? Because it's going to be based in science, but I don't know how much science you're actually interested in. Okay, so let's just see how it goes. Some lots, but some of you might not be so interested in some of the scientific content. I guess it's like me going along to a talk and listening to a historian. Now, I kind of like history, but it doesn't excite me as much as, say, like somebody talking about the Parley Camera or whatever. So let's just see how this goes. The second thing is, why am I doing this? Well, as you know, one of the central teachings of Buddhism is conditioned arising. Yeah, so you've got this great vision of existence, a constant and ceaseless arising of phenomenon, and a passing away of phenomenon. A vision of existence which does not allow for things being fixed, etc. Now, I do believe that that's a true and accurate vision of how things are. And I do believe that to the extent that I am not participating in things as they really are, I'm going to suffer in one way or another, immediately or down the line, etc. So I'm going to be exploring this great vision, if you like, which Buddhism offers for the rest of my life. And that's fantastic, that I've got something to explore for the rest of my life. I'm going to be exploring it through meditation. I'm going to be exploring it through study. I'm going to be exploring it through friendship. I'm going to be exploring it by going on retreat. I'm going to explore it, just in my daily interactions with people. And I have a lot of confidence that it's just an open-ended exploration, which is just going to enrich my life more and more. But I don't just do it through Buddhism. I do it through otherwise. I do it through science, as it happens, and that's why I'm up here now. I mean, I'm up here tonight primarily as a Dharma practitioner, but secondarily as a scientist. I work at the university, and my background is in science. I did a degree, PhD, etc., research. So, and I love science because what it does. I'm not interested in science as a dry academic exercise. I'm not interested in science describing how things are. What I'm really interested in is the beauty behind the concepts. Because what I hope to show you tonight is that, yes, there's a lot of conceptual stuff in science, and it has to do that, it has to communicate through concepts. But behind the concepts is a whole world of conditionality. Because, those of you who've done a course I've done, normally I get out a chart showing a cell. And, even if we just look inside a single cell in our body, it's mind-blowingly, there's just so much which is going on inside every single cell of your body, which has to happen to keep you alive. And to be honest, I mean, I often stop myself and think, goodness me, the fact that I'm alive, is quite a miracle in itself. So that's why I'm here. I'm here to communicate to you something of what turns me on in science and opens up a vista of the wonder, the mystery, actually, of this universe. Now, so we're going to do it through science. We're going to be looking at consciousness. Because, of course, consciousness is the matter of Buddhism. That's what Buddhism kind of focuses on. And it's what we do with consciousness which Buddhism focuses on. And so what we'd like to do, myself and Chris, we want to explore consciousness. We want to explore it through science. We want to explore it through philosophy. And we want to explore it through Buddhism. And tonight we're going to be looking at the scientific exploration. Now, I've got loads of slides, right? Really, I've got loads of slides. I won't tell you how many. I'm going to keep my eye on the time, so I've started at 7:30, all right? 7:30. I could talk very, very easily for 2 hours at least, I'm not going to, but I could, okay? Because all I can do tonight is just scratch the surface. So, I want to start with a definition. What are we dealing with? Consciousness. So, consciousness actually derives from the Latin conscientia, which primarily means moral conscience or shared knowledge, which is quite interesting in itself. It's immediately saying that consciousness is interactive with others. And I think that's one of the great qualities of consciousness. It allows us to interact with the world. Oxford Dictionary gives a much drier definition. It's awareness of, and it's the totality of a person's thoughts and feelings, or a class of these. So that's what we're starting off with. There's nothing new. The exploration of consciousness is nothing new at all. I mean, it's been going on since earlier than the 1600s. People have realised, you know, that something's going on, but they don't know what. And they've, and I'm going to make an assumption, right? I'm going to make an assumption that the brain is heavily involved in consciousness. Whether that is my... So that's what I'm presuming. And in the 1600s, people were doing deep dissections of the brain to try and understand what this fantastic organ in the head actually does. And they got some pretty... Even in the 1600s, they're getting pretty close to allocating certain areas of the brain to emotions or motivation, etc. So it's nothing new. The study of consciousness is nothing new. So any kind of approach to consciousness has to kind of address some of the qualities of consciousness. Qualities such as subjectivity, I, you, me, this, that, etc. Self-awareness. We're all kind of in our waking state, at least. We're all self-aware. And there's a sentience quality associated with consciousness, which means the ability to perceive our world through the senses. There's also what's called sapience. It's the, you know, we can do something with the information which comes into our minds. We can think about it. We can think about it creatively or destructively. And another quality of consciousness is the ability to perceive relationship to oneself and one's environment. Is it threatening? Is it friendly? What can I get out of it? What can't I get out of it? Etc. So we're interacting with our environment all the time through consciousness in our waking state. So any kind of approach to consciousness has to bear in mind or be able to take into account these qualities of consciousness. At least scientifically. So, okay, I'm making an assumption, right? Now, whether this is my position or not, we can maybe debate later on. I'm assuming that the brain, most neuroscientists, assume that the human brain is absolutely essential to consciousness. Now, of course, in the Buddhist tradition, that's debatable, because after death, consciousness is thought to not be destroyed. So, Buddhism immediately starts to clash here, but I'm going to take this, assumption. So, just a few things. It's the most complex, an organ, yet discovered. It's extremely complex, and that includes all the other organs in your body. Your kidney right now is doing some amazing things, and it's full of different cells, but the brain is the eye. How the hell... how does the eye work? And it's an incredibly complex organ, but the brain is much, it beats everything. And it weighs, on average, between 1,300 to 1,500 grams, which in the old system is between 3 to 4 pounds. And this is the thing, it consists of over 11 billion specialised nerve cells. That's a lot. But it's not the number which amazes, it's the way they're connected which amazes. You imagine... You're right, during embryonic, and there's a lot more brain cells in the embryo than there is in the adult brain. But you imagine trying to put all of this lot into order. How the hell do you put 11 billion bits of the brain into order? So there's your first thing, right? The brain is absolutely amazing. Now, look, I want to start off, right? Karl Popper is a great critique of science, amongst other things. He asserted that knowledge and understanding advanced not through asking for definitions, of what things are, but through asking why they occur and how they work. So what I'm not going to do tonight, I'm not going to give definitions of consciousness, okay? And that's precisely what Buddhism does. It doesn't try and define things. It says, well, what are they and how do they work? What are the processes involved in reactivity and creativity, etc.? So I'm not going to get into definitions, okay? So what I want to do this evening, I've got slides which address all of these. Whether I go through all of them or not, I will see. But I don't think you can understand the human brain unless you look at its evolution. You know, and I don't think you can understand the human brain unless you understand what its building blocks are. Neurons, yeah? I don't think you can understand the brain or consciousness from a scientific point of view unless you look at the main structures of the brain. And then we're going to look at one theory of consciousness. Now, there is about four or five theories of consciousness out there at the moment, and I've chosen one because it's my favourite one. And I think when we come on to the Buddhism bit, I'm going to try and make some links between this theory of consciousness and what Buddhism has to say about consciousness. It's a theory put forward first developed in 1997 by Alderman. And it's called neuronal Darwinism. So if you want to do a Google, do Google and have a look. He's a Canadian neuroscientist who's done a lot of work. And actually he's very interested in the mystical experiences which the brain can have. And then we'll conclude. Now, let's put this into perspective sometimes. You know, sometimes we walk along the street and we think, you know, I'm a human being and I'm pretty, you know, we walk tall, we walk proud. Actually, we're just a little speck. You know, we're just a little speck, whether we like that or not. Look at this. This is a 24-hour clock, right? And what it's saying is that human, Homo sapiens, us, have been around, that we came into existence at 11:59 p.m. We've only been around 1 minute on this 24-hour clock. Now, there's been a hell of a lot which has been going on this clock. And life, as you know, organic life was thought to have evolved around 3.9 million years ago, which is at 12 minutes past 3 in the morning. And there's been a lot going on. We'll have a look at photosynthesis in a minute, and then we come round to us. So really, we're just a little speck in terms of the evolution of life on this planet. And I also want to make the point that we're standing on a huge number of processes. We would not be able to live on this planet if it wasn't for plants. So, you know, hats off to plants, eh? We just wouldn't be here. So what I'm saying is we're actually standing on a lot of shoulders. You know, in other words, conditionality. You know, without these primary producers, these plants, we've had it. We cannot fix our own energy. Plants fix energy from the sunlight, and they turn that energy into chemical energy, which then we eat, either directly as vegetarians or indirectly through meat, which has been fixed, you know, by the animal. Now, this is an interesting fact. You know, talking about the importance of photosynthesis, it's been estimated that 100 billion tons of sugar, that's the basic kind of unit of energy, if you like, the molecule of energy on this planet, which plants make for us and we eat. It's been estimated that 100 billion tons of sugar is made every year by green plants, which is equivalent to 666 million blue whales. Now, isn't that staggering, eh? The weight of 666 million blue whales is made by plants in glucose. Thank goodness they do. Okay, that's the perspective, right? We're standing on an enormous amount of evolution. We're standing on these great factories called plants. So I just want to look at the evolution of the human brain briefly. Just to remind me, this is just a part of the evolutionary tree. And what we can see is around about 6 million years ago, there was a common ancestor which gave rise to the Homo lineage, which is us, and the chimpanzee lineage. So the chimpanzees are... they're most closely related to us. The chimpanzee genome has now been sequenced, and it's 97% similar to Homo sapiens genome. So there's only a difference of 3% in the genome. I mean genes which do things in the body. So 6 million years ago, something it started. The evolution of Homo sapiens started. And again, I just wanted to say, look, I mean, there's us, right? Homo sapiens, and we're just a little glitch. You know, we haven't been around for very long. Look at Homo erectus. You know, Homo erectus has been around for many, 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 many billion, thousands of years than we have, and yet they died out. Why? Homo habilis as well, and there's all these kinds of hominids. Now, the relationship of these hominids to us is not actually been worked out fully. But I just wanted to make the point that, again, you know, we've come through a very sophisticated path of evolution. And just these are kind of pictures of what these different early hominid species might have looked like. So this early species of hominid we're talking around here. These were probably the first ones to leave the forest and go into the savannah. Now, the savannah posed enormously new and novel challenges, and that's probably why the human brain evolved as it did. The going out into the savannah had it posed new dangers than the forest did, and scientists think that this move from the forest to the savannah pushed very strongly the evolution of the human brain. We had to adapt to the savannah, otherwise we'd been wiped out and stayed in the forest. And then Homo habilis, around 2 million years ago, there's evidence that that's the first use of tools. And then, of course, fire. Fire is enormously important because, as we'll see later, it allowed early hominid species to cook. To cook and make use of very high protein foods derived from animals, which again was diet was crucial in the evolution of the human brain, as we'll look at in a minute. And then finally, Homo sapiens, 100,000 years ago. We haven't been around long. Now, as you look at the evolution of hominid species, you begin to see that the evolution of consciousness, or you know, more complex consciousness, was accompanied by art. Now, this is an ivory statue at about 30,000 years old, and what it shows is that whoever made this had to think abstractly. They had to be able to think, what's it like to put a feline face on a human body? 12,000 years ago. These are very famous paintings from deep caves in Spain. Again, what these represent, these pictures represent, is the ability of the artist to remember things. You know, you couldn't do this without being able to remember what a bison looked like. So, and then with that memory, kind of translate it into an image. So the evolution of human consciousness is kind of paralleled by an evolution of more and more sophisticated art. Okay, so now I've got to say, the evolution of consciousness is in a way is wrapped up with two things: the evolution of brain size and also the specialization of that brain. The really interesting thing about the evolution of brain size is that there's been this kind of slow evolution of brain size through hominid evolution, but a spike in brain size occurred about 1.5 million years ago, and it really is very pronounced. This is a graph showing which plots time, millions of years, against relative brain size. And I want you to just look at this this area here, because what this is this at this point the common ancestor, the diverged chimp, to give chimpanzees and humans. And you can see this enormous expansion in human brain size. And that, in evolutionary terms, is really quite enormously rapid. So something provoked or stimulated this massive evolution, relatively speaking, to time, of the human brain. The other thing, complex brains have not evolved just once. They haven't, because you know they're in the you know, dolphins and whales have got pretty complex brains, but they evolved in separate lineages from hominids, which is quite interesting, really, because the fact that the human, well, the brain has evolved in different, it's come up, evolution has come up with the brain more than once, basically. But there are special things as regards the human brain, which we'll come into in a minute. So this is just showing what evolution has thrown up in terms of brain size. So there's the human. The human has the largest weight of brain equivalent to relative to body size on this planet. And the chimpanzee, which is our closest relative, has a brain size around 400 grams. And this is just showing you that, again, putting it into a different perspective, there's these are to scale, so there's the human brain. The dolphin brain is a bit larger than the human brain, but it's not as it hasn't got the same structures as the human brain. Okay, this is where I'm going to skip over. This is a slide which I show to students sometimes, and basically what scientists are doing, they're beginning to discover now certain genes which they think were involved in this massive expansion of brain size. And what these genes do, they encode, I'm not going to go into details, they encode proteins which control the plane of cell division. So in the brain, in early brain development, if cells divide that way, they remain as what's called stem cells, so that they can make lots and lots of, they can see the production of brain cells. If the cells divide in that direction, then the mother cell stays as the progenitor, and the daughter cell differentiates into a brain cell. So the more seeding cells you've got, the bigger the brain. So what these genes do, they evolved. They're not found anywhere else, actually, which is quite interesting, in the in life, and they control the planes of cell division, which is very interesting. Okay, so I will get onto consciousness, really. Is this all right? Okay. All right, so I've just told you that brain size showed this massive expansion, but it wasn't just the size, it was the way the brain was organised which changed as well. It's the cerebral cortex, that stuff on the top of the brain. It's massive compared to the rest of the brain and compared to the size of the cerebral cortex in other mammals. This is just it's called a magnetic resonance imaging. So what they've done here is they've magnetically resolved, if you like, the human brain, and they've magnetically resolved a bonobo down here, chimpanzee, closest relative brain. And what they've done is they've superimposed them. And what this diagram is showing is that the red bits are the bits which show big, big differences in our brain compared to a chimp brain. And what you can see, this is at the front of the brain. There's some big, big differences at the front of the brain, for example. There are other changes as well. But as we'll see later, the front of the brain was thought to have evolved to allow or promote social interactions, and social interactions are crucial in evolution. This is just showing you that this cortex, this stuff which sits on top of our brain, is massive, say, compared to a rat, which has just got a little bit. So our brain is not just a scaled-up version of any other brain on this planet. It's similar to, say, like a whale or dolphin one or a chimpanzee, but it's very different. Now, I'm not going to say much about this slide. I just want you to look at this second line down, because the human brain is enormously expensive. It takes up a lot of our energy. And also, it's so kind of populated by blood vessels, it takes up a lot of blood. So evolution does not come up with things like as expensive as the brain, unless it gives some really important survival advantages. I can't stress that enough. The human brain is enormously demanding on our bodies. And kind of what probably happened with the co-evolution of this our brain happened, the stomachs got smaller and they got much more efficient at getting nutrients out of food, which of course was crucial to be able to support this brain. The one part of the brain which, as I say, c- compared to the bonobo, is very different, is much more developed, is what's called the neocortex. And you can ask, well, why is that one, for example, why is that region differentially expanded? Well, the neocortex allows us to analyse our environment and come up with variable behaviour in response to situations. So instead of, I don't know, every time, you know, somebody says, Marshall, you're a whatever, the neocortex allows me to react differently to how I might normally react. In other words, it allows creative behaviour. And of course, the environment, if you're going on to the savannah, created loads and loads of different challenges, and the human brain had to adapt to these different ambiguities. Things were not as they were in the forest. And I think that's where I'll stop there. But this neocortex allowed social behaviour to develop, and that is really crucial, isn't it? I mean, you think of what can be done. You know, some of the seven wonders of the world, they wouldn't have happened unless there was cooperation. I mean, buildings, you know, getting buildings done. Okay, I'm going to ignore that one. And now, I'm not sure how much to go into this. Do you want to hear about... Okay, let's see how it goes. So the basic building block of our brain is what's called a neuron. Now, the reason why I'm showing you this slide and the one after it is because these in themselves are wonders of evolution. What you see here is a neuron which in your brain conducts electricity. And of course, the language of the brain, you know, the currency of transmission of information in the brain is largely electrical, but also chemical as well. So you imagine this cell has had to evolve from just a round cell. Yeah? So this is a wonder of evolution in itself. Because you've got all these spiky bits here, and then the cell had to stretch itself out to give a little tail. And then on the end of the tail, you had to have some more squiggly bits. And these are highly, highly specialised cells. And again, you know, when I sit down and I think, how did this evolve? Well, who knows. But it's a fundamental building block to not just our brain, but brains of and the central nervous system of other animals. There's lots of different shapes of them. Evolution has said, right, we've got a lot of different things to do in this complex brain. Let's evolve different ones which can do different things. Now, I've got to show you this because this is another wonder of evolution, right? Let's go back. What I've said is that what happens is this cell, this neuron is connected to another one up here. So an electrical pulse crosses boundaries and it's transferred from a connecting neuron to this one here. Then the electrical impulse goes along here to the end and then it's fired off to another connecting cell, okay? Now, what you've got here along this stretched out bit is bundles of fat, bundles of lipid. And this was such an important evolutionary development. Because what it allows the electrical impulse to jump. What the electrical impulse does in the neuron, it jumps between these fat bundles. It doesn't have to go along the length of the body. It jumps. And the fact that it can jump means that electrical impulses can be transmitted up to 100 metres per second in your brain. And that is absolutely crucial because we're having to analyse a lot of information very, very quickly. We're having to assess our environment very, very quickly. And the faster information can be transmitted, the better we can do that. So these little bundles, again, all it is fat. You know, it's lipid. And yet, evolutionarily speaking, it changed things enormously. I'm not going to go on to that. It's just saying that, you know, electrical signals have to be converted into chemical signals, which are then converted into electrical signals. Again, another wonder of evolution. And I'm probably going to skip this one as well, although it really is fascinating. What these slides are saying is, you know, you've got these, say, like billions and billions of, they're very immature neurons during early development in the fetus, and they're just a little. What they are, the early neurons are just a little. They've got a bulb, and they've got a little extension, but on the end of the extension, they've got another little bulb, which is called the neural growth cone. So somehow, right, these billions of developing neurons have got to know where to go in the brain. They've got to know where to connect in the brain. Because as I say, if they don't, we're in trouble. You know, we can't function. And again, evolution is, I don't know, you know, evolution, it says, hey, we can solve this. And it solved it. What it solved it by is on the end of these kind of, what these growth cones, are what are called receptors. And receptors bind or search out, they search out specific molecules, right? What evolution has come up with is, it's come up with a whole chemical language which helps these neuron growth cones to know where they are. You imagine driving from here to Birmingham, right? And you've never seen a map before. Well, how would you get there? You'd need signposts. So evolution has come up with it places chemical signposts in the developing brain to say, right, come over here, you, or another chemical might say, oi, come over here. You know, you need to be in the optic nerve. Or, oi, come over here, you need to be in the hippocampus. You know, you need to be thinking about memory. So it's quite, the chemical language, the chemical language of the brain is enormous. It's like, you know, you say you've got eight languages in the brain. You've got English, French, German, Spanish, Urdu, Hindi, Chinese, Japanese, etc., etc. What these, when I say receptors, what these specific receptors on the end of these neural growth cones on, they've got receptors which say recognize the Urdu language only. So they listen out for the Urdu language, right? Because they've got these special receptors. Whereas other different groups of neurons might have a receptor which listens out for the English language, which has been transmitted from the brain. Yeah, so it's absolutely amazing. As I say, this is what science does to me. When you look at it, you think, my goodness, you know, we shouldn't, you know, how this has all happened, I don't know. And yet we just take ourselves so much for granted. I think, well, yeah. Again, this is something which I sometimes show students. It's, and I'm not going to go through it. It's how neurons find their way in the fruit fly brain from their source to where they've got to go to. Okay, so let's start now moving. We've been going for half an hour, so we're going to start now moving into consciousness a bit. But as I say, consciousness, we need to have a look at the key parts of the human brain. So the human brain does a lot, doesn't it, really? It senses the environment. It coordinates movement. It makes judgments of things. It assesses the environment. What do I do here? A lot of brain actually material is devoted to vision. It coordinates things. You know, if I can't play tennis without coordination, I can't walk along the street without coordination. There's memory. You know, we can't function without memory. You know, as some terrible diseases show, that, you know, without memory we're in real trouble. There's also reward. You know, the brain, as we'll see later, the brain's come up with a very, very good system. It's called the reward pathway, which every time we do something which helps us, helps our survival, it goes bing, it releases this chemical called dopamine, which makes us feel good. Again, a beautiful trick of evolution. But, and yet, you know, unfortunately, it can be very abused, because people who get addicted to recreational drugs, for example, this pathway, as we'll see later, is just overstimulated. So, more pictorially, we're going to look at just three basic units of the human brain. The primitive brain, and this is all, and all of these three units are involved in this theory of consciousness. That's why I'm telling you, I'm not just telling you for the sake of it, I'm telling you because they're all involved in this theory of consciousness. The primitive brain, which is involved in, you know, found in reptiles upwards, it's involved in self-preservation and aggression. Aggression is a great way to preserve yourself. And then there's what's called the limbic system, a very highly complex part of the brain which is involved in emotions. And then the neocortex, which is on the top bit on the brain, is involved with rational analysis, intellectual tasks. So we're going to just bear those three in mind. So let's just have a quick look at these bits of the brain. First of all, the reptilian brain. As probably some of you know, it sits almost on top of the spinal cord. And again, this is not a brain which the part of the brain which is unique to us. It's found it's evolved in reptiles onwards. It evolved around 500 million years ago. So 500 million years ago, evolution was coming up with some early brains. And it's the oldest region of our brains, and it's to do with, you know, fight and flight, heart rate, etc. But the thing is, it lacks language, and as we'll see a little later, the human brain evolved specific regions which can allow language. We can speak and we can interpret language, and that is really, really important. You imagine, what if you can't speak? How that might, if you can't communicate, how that might affect your life in relationship to other people. Now, around 250 million years ago, so we've got a gap of 250 million years approximately. So that's a long time, isn't it, really? But it took around about 250 million years ago for this highly complex kind of, it's a bunch of different structures of the brain called the limbic system. And you can, this is the limbic system here. So it's made up of these different kind of structures, and they all contain, they all do different things. And the great thing about the brain is that somehow it can hold together signals from all these different parts of the brain, as we'll see later. And the limbic system is to do with memory. It's to do with more complex emotions other than the fight and flight. A very important part of the brain. And finally, about 200 million years ago, the cerebrum was developed, and that's the stuff on top, if you like, the stuff on top of the brain. So, all right then. So, good. We've spent half an hour, well, 32 minutes to be precise, going through a whistle-top tour of some what I think are some salient features of consciousness, putting the building blocks to move on to consciousness. So, what about it? Well, this is for Chris Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. Started to think about consciousness in terms of mind and matter. But anyway. So, consciousness, right? So neuroscientists say, right, okay, so the brain's really important in consciousness. What's the brain made up of? Well, it's made up of neurons. You know, these highly specialised cells, which I showed earlier. So obviously you think, well, okay, the substrate of consciousness, what allows consciousness to arise, or what supports consciousness, is neurons. William James in 1870 really started to take consciousness seriously. Thought it was the whole brain. He thought the whole brain was involved in consciousness. But the way neuroscience is going now is that that's not actually true, and I think that's probably true. So more recent questions in the last 5 years in particular have been, you know, are there neurons in the brain endowed with a special location? You know, location A, you're involved in consciousness. Location B, you're not involved in consciousness. So is there a special location or intrinsic property of the neurons? Are specific neurons which are made in a certain shape, are they associated with consciousness only? So there's a problem here. You know, when you start to think about it, how could the possession of some particular location, you know, a particular location of a particular neuron in the brain render some neurons, you know, able to support consciousness? You know, what surely that's a bit crazy, isn't it? Location. An alternative question is, well, what kind of neural processes might account for key properties of conscious experience? Is it, rather than where the neurons are located in the brain, is it what kind of processes they can carry out which is more important? Well, actually, it's both, probably. Well, according to this Edelman fella, it's both, as we'll look at now. So is there any kind of theories out there which can account for the qualities of consciousness which we touched upon earlier? Well, they're beginning to emerge. Now, I must say I do not take the position that science will solve the mystery of consciousness. And I hope it doesn't. because that, you know, the mystery of consciousness will be solved for me by spiritual practice. Because you know, let's think about it. What are the salient features of our conscious experience? Well, first of all, conscious states are unitary. In other words, they're composed. The brain's assembling all these different bits of information. For example, to allow me to talk to you. Yeah. And they're integrated. There's an integration in every single conscious moment, because you know, you can be conscious of loads of things right now. You can be conscious of textures, colours, sounds, smells, and yet you're not. Well, you know, there's a kind of a primary kind of a unitary consciousness which is allowing you to listen to what I'm saying, maybe. So as well as integration, as I say, there's this enormously kind of diverse and range of states which consciousness can be conscious of at any time. And they're temporally ordered. You know, moments of consciousness, no matter what we think, moments of consciousness are fractions of a second. And the neuroscience has shown this, because, you know, the actual neural outputs and neural activity is changing all the time. No matter what we think, that there's something staying constant, it's not. Another feature of consciousness is that it shows intentionality. You intend to do things. You give consciousness direction, don't you? And intentionality has to be explained. It's, you know, in consciousness, there's, as I say, there's this problem of there's a central area of focus, and yet, you know, the brain's able also, or consciousness is able to stay aware of things in the periphery as well. So I'm aware that Gary's eyes are closing. Or are they? I was joking. But, you know, so there's a focus and there's the periphery. And there's a subjective, you know. How is it that we can, consciousness allows us to experience feeling, mood, pleasure, and unpleasure? How is it that consciousness can allow that to happen? How is it that consciousness can kind of give us a kind of a placement in the world? You know. So I would say straight away that consciousness, and this is amongst many neuroscientists now, it is not regarded as a thing, and few, thank goodness. That would be awful, I think, you know. And it's regarded as a something, which it's regarded as a process. And that's fantastic, you know, because any process can be given direction. And it's, as I say, it's a process or stream that is changing on a time scale of fractions of seconds. And it emerges from the interaction of the brain, the body, and the environment. And current theory, and I'm going to say a bit about this because it's kind of, it has implications for mindfulness. Current theory categorizes two processes which are really crucial to consciousness. There's the first of all, that consciousness is integrated. What that means is I'll explain in a minute. And the other thing is that consciousness is highly differentiated, and I'll explain these terms in a minute. Now, in fact. So integration, it's what that means is it's the property shared by every conscious moment. And what that means is that we see the redness. If a red square is put in front of you, what you see immediately, you see the redness of a square. You don't first of all see the red and then the square. So integration is like putting together diverse bits of information very, very quickly into one package so that you can say, that is a red square. So that's integration. And there are I don't know if you've heard of split brain patients where the left and the right hemisphere, the communication of the left and the right hemisphere has been unfortunately distorted. And where integration is kind of destroyed. So there's integration, there's the ability to the consciousness to put together information very, very quickly to allow us to give us a single scene. It's called a S-C-E-N-E, it's a scene. So you see the red square straight away, rather than the different characteristics and then assemble them over a period of time. Whereas differentiation is despite this integration, as I say, the human brain, consciousness, has a choice. It has a choice what to be conscious of. And somehow, we can easily discriminate between innumerable scenes within a fraction of a second. So within 1 second, I can be looking at different things, I can be sensing different things. And I look over there, the wall, and then I look back, and immediately my brain say, pictures of the Buddha, of the life of the Buddha. Very, very quickly I look over there, a flame. So whenever I look, wherever I look, I can look all over the place. And yet, and whatever I look at, the brain has to put together that information very, very quickly into a single scene. So, the occurrence of the, consciousness allows us to do that. So differentiation without integration, this is all about mindfulness now, leads to a lot of information, but it's not tied into a scene. In other words, we've got lots of information coming in, but, we're kind of just, we're not really doing much of it. You're kind of meandering around. And I think that's partly, the role of mindfulness, is that we've got all this information coming in, and it's pulling us all over the place. And mindfulness is saying, settle down, keep integrated, settle down, give your consciousness intentionality. And integration without differentiation means that you're too focused. You don't allow in the possibilities of consciousness, your possibilities. So this theory of consciousness, which we'll come on to in a tick, explains integration and differentiation. They're just very, very interesting terms, to think about. A way to think about your consciousness. But there are problems. There's a lot of problems in the field. How does consciousness make sense of all this different information available at any one time? What about this property of intentionality? How the hell can, if you want to be a reductionist, how can chemicals and electrical signals, how can they give this quality of consciousness called intentionality? Subjective feelings. These are the three main areas which theories of consciousness just haven't got to grips with at all. Subjective feelings. How does consciousness, the redness of red, the warmth of warm, how are subjective feelings, which are very powerful in us, how do they arise in consciousness? Now, in the last 10 minutes, we're going to look at this theory of consciousness. So consciousness, according to Edelman, it's not a property of a single brain location, or it's not a property of a single neural type. Rather, it's a result of dynamic interactions among different parts of your brain. And the major system, which is agreed now by many, many different neuroscientists in the field, the major system which supports consciousness is the thalamocortical system, it's called. And I'm not going to go into many details here. This is it here. It consists of very highly complex parts of the brain. You've got the limbic system, and you've got within the limbic system you've got these like the hippocampus, which converts how the hell it does it, I don't know, but electrical energy into it stores memory in chemical form. And you've got this structure here, which is to do with emotions. You've got structures over here, which are primarily to do with the reward pathway, which are giving you buzzes of feel-good factors if you do things which help your survival, like eat a bit of food or drink a bit of water, and it's also involved in sexual arousal as well. And then you've got the neocortex areas, which are doing a lot of processing of information. So, and then the thalamus is like a kind of a call centre. It receives lots and lots of information, then it processes it, and then sends out other signals. So consciousness involves communication between different parts, different structures of the brain, according to this theory. And I'm just, the thalamus is an important part, and the hippocampus there, deep in, it's the midbrain, really. Don't worry about those. So what they've been, you know, to show, to kind of study how different parts of the brain communicate. Again, we're back to nuclear magnetic resonance. It's a highly, highly sensitive technique which looks at electrical impulses across the brain. So in experiments like this, subjects are given things to look at, a red thing or a warm thing, or they're given a threatening situation or not. And then this technique will look at electrical impulses and what happens in the brain. So a lot of information is going to come out of this technique in the next few years. I don't know whether to go into this or not. This is what's called neural Darwinism. And okay, so basically what it's saying in a nutshell is that upon birth, in the developing fetus, and particularly after birth, a lot of neurons haven't made connections. And they make connections according to one's experience. So, for example, if I touch something hot, a neural connection is strengthened, which says, this thing is hot, it gives pain, don't touch it again. So during our development, neural pathways are put up, are made. But also communications between different parts of the brain are made as well. And this is just a schematic again showing that, you know, brain connections, connections in different parts of the brain, say the limbic system and other parts of the cortex of the brain, are very, very important, because different parts of the brain do different things and they have to be connected. And a classic kind of connected pathway is the reward pathway. And when this goes wrong, we get addicted. Because what the reward pathway is about it rewards certain behaviours with a release of a chemical called dopamine, which makes us feel really good and happy. And the reward pathway requires a lot of communication between different parts of the brain. So during our development, different parts of the brain get connected, and according to the reward, they get highly strengthened. This is just an example. I mean, the brain can change. You know, not only can the brain change in terms of connections, the bottom line is use it or lose it. You know, the brain remains plastic. In other words, it can change right up until death. There's very few things, well, there are things fixed in your brain, but, you know, you can always learn a new language, for example. And that, you can do that because neural connections can release from each other and make another connection elsewhere. Because if the brain was set, the neural connections are set, we wouldn't be able to learn. So there's a lot of plasticity in the brain, so use it. If you don't use it, the brain, there's evidence to suggest that, you know, it can start decaying a bit quicker. This is an example taken from a single neuron from brains. This shows that structure can change as well. This is a normal brain cell. And these little bobs here, they contain receptors for dopamine. And this is a brain cell from a meth-addicted brain. And you can see the structures of the neurons are very, very different. And what this one is has many more receptors for this chemical called dopamine. So in other words, every time somebody takes a recreational drug, they get this massive hit because their brain has been sensitized to this chemical called dopamine, which is released when they take the drug. So, and also some current research has shown that there are, again, changes in structure of the brain in meditators and non-meditators, particularly in the region of the brain which is to do with positive emotion. So don't give up, basically. You know, it happens. You know, changes do happen. I mean, that's unfortunately a negative thing, but... I just wanted to... Okay, almost there. I just wanted to draw your attention to this current theories of consciousness divide consciousness into primary consciousness and higher consciousness. So primary consciousness is very basic. You go to water, you drink water, it feels good. Right, I remember that. So this kind of behavior, primary consciousness is found in some reptiles and above. So it's a level of consciousness which allows an organism or animal to remember the past, particularly the past which rewards them with food or water or sex or whatever. We've got that going on. And some people argue that what meditation is doing, it's taking us from a higher conscious, or a kind of a higher order conscious, which is defined in the next slide, to a primary conscious. Primary consciousness is to do with very little processing information. Information comes in, and that's it. You know, there's no kind of higher thinking associated with that. Whereas higher consciousness, as exhibited by us, it does a lot of thinking, does a lot of processing of information which comes in. But also, higher consciousness, it requires linguistic ability, the ability of us to be able to tell other people how we're feeling. You know, empathy is very much part of our social evolution. The ability to communicate how we feel to another human being is crucial, if you think about it. So, this slide is just summarising. You've got this primary consciousness going on with us, but you've also got a higher order consciousness, and as defined by neuroscientists, which is basically allowing us to communicate with other people, and we can symbolise how we're feeling. I can tell you how I'm feeling through symbols, or my heart is as happy as the burning sun, or I feel as sad as a frozen pipe, or whatever. So finally, there's not that much out there, okay, in terms of theories of consciousness. But this is an interesting one. It's called. This is part of the theory of Alderman as well. It's called the dynamic core. And what he says is that anything which is included in the dynamic core, that's what we're conscious of. Anything which is outside of the dynamic core, we're not conscious of. So basically what he's saying is the dynamic core holds together information from the senses, from our feeling centres, etc. And holds it together into a unitary package. And then I can say right now how I'm feeling and what I'm looking at and what I'm experiencing. And the dynamic core kind of floats around the brain. So that's the dynamic core allows us to be conscious of different things. So the dynamic core is floating around, and wherever it sits, if you like, that's what we're conscious of. And don't forget, the dynamic core is pulling out information from all the different organs, different parts of the brain. As I've said here, consciousness and unconscious. Conscious behaviour is included in the dynamic core, and conscious behaviour is not. So there's a lot of our experience which is unconscious. Of course it is. You know, I'm not aware of my heart going boom boom. You know, I can't control my heart. But you know, similarly, I'm relatively unconscious of quite a bit of Umar Shraddharism. And hopefully, I can bring more and more of Umar Shraddharism into the dynamic core, so that maybe the Buddha drew up everything into the dynamic core. But that's being silly, really. So conclusions. Okay, wow, 50 minutes. Conclusions, well, I would say the evolution of consciousness is inseparable from the evolution of the human brain. There's some very elegant work being done now looking at comparing the structures of different brains, the bird brain. It's very complex, and birds can do a lot of complex behaviour, like the hummingbird can guide itself to minute distances, and it can preen itself, and it can display really complex mating behaviour, and yet its brain is tiny. So there's a lot of work being done now, looking much more closely at structures, particularly structures of the brain, and how they might support different elements of consciousness. Mind or consciousness is a complex structure, and it's derived not from any one part of the brain, but different parts of the brain. And you think about it, 11 billion neurons, right? And most of them are firing most of the time. That's a lot of information. That's a lot of information for consciousness, if you like, to be conscious, you know, to select from and be conscious of. You know, consciousness is something quite amazing. And, you know, this whole area of all, and I'm not a reductionist, but some people are, will say,
okay, so how does all this flows of electricity and chemicals give rise to inner subjective experience? How does it give rise to me be able to say, to describe to you the redness of red or a particular mood, etc.? So there's a lot of work being done at the moment. It's very, very interesting work, and I'm sure, you know, some of it finds itself into the local press. So I think there's going to be a lot of new information coming out in the next 2 years on studies of consciousness. But I don't, as I say, I use it as part, you know, to keep my practice alive, to keep my sense of wonder alive. I don't get, you know, I'm not just purely into it because of the concepts and the interest.